All right, good evening, everyone. We are going to be looking at number two installment of probably four, sometimes scattered through the year, of some manners and customs of Bible times. A couple of months ago, we looked at weddings and wedding ceremonies and looked at a lot of passages that were in the Bible using that kind of symbolism. And to help us understand some of the philosophy and some of the customs that they had surrounding marriage and weddings and how that related to a lot of both Old Testament and New Testament passages. And had enough good comments from that that I decided to try it again. So we're going to talk tonight about children and some family aspects, but primarily at a young age. We're going to be looking at some readings again tonight. I might have to call on a person or two to help me out with a reading. A lot of tonight we're going to be looking at some of the old Jewish writings as well, to give us a little bit of flavor for what their thinking was and how they considered the concept of having children and family obligations and those kinds of things, and looking at very young ages. So anyway, that's what we're going to look at shortly. Before we start, in just a moment, I'm going to have Joe lead a couple of songs, and then we'll kind of get into it a little bit. About halfway through, we're going to stop, and we'll sing a couple more songs. And then we'll finish up, and Josh will lead us in a final song there as well. Before we start tonight, I'm going to ask Rick if you would to lead us in a word of prayer, please. Okay, so I think I mentioned what we're going to primarily cover is the first point is going to be why children are culturally important as we start looking at some Old Testament passages and trying to understand how they really felt and why they felt that way about children. And then we're going to look at some Jewish customs related to birth and circumcision, the preference for sons, which is an interesting piece there, and the emerging from childhood, what happens when you leave that childhood behind and where that comes in relation to their ages and things. So that's going to be the topics that we'll cover. I want to start out with two songs. We're saying God of Our Fathers and God is the Fountain Whence. God of Our Fathers, just because I love that song. And God is the Fountain Whence because it starts out with one of the themes that we're going to be talking about in a little bit more. So, Joe, if you would help us out here.
God of our fathers, whose almighty hand leads forth in beauty all the starry band of shining worlds in splendor through the skies, our grateful songs before thy throne arise. Thy love divine hath led us in the past. In this free land, by thee our lot is cast. Be thou our ruler, guardian. guardian, guide and stay. Thy word our law, thy path our chosen way. Refresh thy people on their toilsome way. Lead us from night to never-ending day. Fill all our lives with love and grace divine. And glory, Lord, and praise be ever thine. God is the fountain whence 10,000 blessings flow. To him my life, my health and friends, and every good I owe. The comforts he affords are neither few nor small. He is the source of fresh delight, my portion and my all. He fills my heart with joy, my lips attuned for praise, and to his glory I'll devote the remnant of my days.
As we look at a lot of the passages in the Old Testament, and by the way, we've got a number of visitors tonight and some new folks with us, and great to have everybody here. Just so that you're aware, this is more of a class-type arrangement. So if you have a question or something, just pop that hand up, and I'll be glad to try to address it, or I'll write it down and answer it later if I don't know the answer, if we can come up with something. So feel free to ask questions. But when you're looking at the Old Testament, remember some passages that talked about why children or what their thoughts was or were about children? Remember this passage when Rachel is married to Jacob, and she doesn't have any children. What does she say? Rachel saw that she bore Jacob no children. She became jealous of her sister, and she said to Jacob, "Give me children, or else I die." And then Jacob's anger burned against Rachel, and he said, "Am I in the place of God who has withheld from you the fruit of the womb?" What do we get out of that verse? What do we get out of that verse? Okay, she's in despair. She is really, really down. Now, that's a normal thing in families. That happens today a lot, too. And a lot of it is that kind of built-in longing that God has put in us for a family, for that closeness and relationship of having children. But in the Jewish culture, there was actually even more to it than that. There's another instance that if someone's got a Bible, you want to look in 1 Samuel, the first chapter. Everybody remember who this one's about? Yeah, this is Hannah. And somebody can read verses 1 through 8 for me there. 1 Samuel 1, verses 1 through 8. I know the electronic Bibles have already got it. Go ahead.
Year by year from the city to birth and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts and Shiloh, but the two sons of Eli
Okay. What do we get out of this? A couple of things there about relationships. The guys don't get it. Okay, number one, the guys just didn't get it, right? They didn't understand. What's the other thing you get? Why in the world did he marry two women? I don't understand that. I mean, that's the other part, right? No modern-day guy looks at this and goes, that's a good thing to do. Obviously, there's some rivalry and some jealousy, just like in the previous one. Now, it's interesting because from a rabbinical standpoint, from a religious standpoint, if there were no children that came from a marriage, the first thing that they considered was that it was the guy's fault. That's the way the rabbis looked at it. But if there were two women, if there were two wives, and one of them had children and the other one didn't, then they thought of it as it's stated there in that phrase. Did it say that she was the problem? What was the statement there that was given about why she wasn't having children? The Lord had closed her womb. Okay? So keep that in mind. And the reason is because when you think about the first aspect they had about children, and we talked about this on our get-together last Saturday and also on the sermon on Sunday, is that children were a blessing from God. That was the number one thing that they put in there. The children were a blessing from God. And this started very early in Deuteronomy chapter 28, when they were listing, this is when they were on Mount Ebal and Mount Gerizim, and they're listing the blessings and the cursings. One of the things that was listed there was, blessed shall be the offspring of your body and the produce of your ground and the offspring of your beasts and the increase of your herd and the young of your flock. Children and an increase in their flocks and everything were considered to be part of a blessing from God. So that was very important to them, because if they had children, then it, to their minds, that was God blessing them. And the more they had, the merrier. Behold, children are a gift of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is a reward. We've been looking at that passage in Psalms 127. Anybody remember where this one is? Genesis 33 and verse 5. This is your closed book quiz here. Who said this? He lifted his eyes and saw the women and the children. He said, who are these with you? So he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. Yeah, that's Jacob answering Esau. Esau's the one who looked up, and Jacob, remember, was afraid to face his brother. But one of the, in the midst of that, how does he talk about his kids? He said, these children. And how many do you have at that point? Nice round dozen, right? Probably 13, because the daughter was in there too. But he's saying these were a blessing from God. Another reader, please. Psalm 128. Short psalm. There's about 7 or 8 verses there. Psalm 128. Go ahead, Larry.
Blessed is everyone who fears the Lord, who walks in his ways. You shall eat the fruit of the labor of your hands. You shall be blessed, and it shall be blessed with you. Your wife will be like a fruitful vine within your house. Your children will be like olive shoots around your table. Behold, thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. The Lord bless you from Zion. May you see the prosperity of Jerusalem all the days of your life. May you see your children's children. Peace be upon Israel.
Okay. Several interesting things in that psalm. He mentions about children. What does he say they are? They're like what?
Olive shoots.
Yeah, what's that all about? Well, the olive was a very agriculturally important plant. But he said your wife will be like a vine around the table and your children like olive shoots. Basically, they'll be a blessing in your house. That's the imagery that he's using there. These two things of the vine and the olives were the kinds of crops that were the mainstay in their land. And so that blessing from the Lord is tied to something else, though, there in that one. He says also, what does he say about Jerusalem there, Larry? Just towards the end. That seems like it's kind of weird thrown in there in the middle of it, doesn't it? May you see the prosperity of Jerusalem. But the idea is that as you are prospering and as the Lord is blessing you, may the Lord bless Jerusalem. Why was Jerusalem to be blessed as well? What's there during David's time? The temple. Well, the temple was not yet in David's time. It was the tabernacle, but the temple was going to be built later, and this psalm is probably later than David. And the idea was that all of this was tied together. Children were part of the great blessings that God was giving the nation, not just the individual family. And then that final one, may you see your children's children. Okay, so that ability to grow up and see them. So they were a blessing from God. But there was another reason that they really, really strongly felt like they had to have children, and as many as they could. Anybody want to know? Yeah. Okay, part of it was preserving the family line. That was certainly one of the things that you see, and we'll talk more about that one in just a minute in one particular famous case. Joe. Yeah, and in fact, the rabbis talk about the fact that sons are adding to the family pool of labor, and so that was one of the things when we get to, you know, why they wanted sons more than daughters, because typically the son would inherit part of the land. What he married, even though it says a son shall leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, actually it was the wife that moved in there, and that became part of the clan. David. Okay, retirement plan. There was another good thing that they were looking at was, you know, the kids had a responsibility, and that was part of their education and training. And what were their responsibilities? And one of those was to take care of their parents. But there was another really fundamental reason right in the beginning. Absolutely. That is considered in Jewish culture to be the first commandment that was given to mankind that we are expected to follow as well. The first one being to Adam, where he said, take care of the garden, right? Well, can't do that because the garden's kind of long gone. But this next one, God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him, male and female. He created them. God blessed them. And God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it. So it was a religious obligation to have children, because God had said and commanded at the beginning to be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. I should have brought an article looking for it. I didn't find it quite in time. My great-grandparents were married for 75 years by the time they died, but 72 when the little country paper where they lived in Alabama wrote an article on them and, you know, listed out a lot of their, you know, how many kids and grandkids and great-grandkids. And I think they had like 6 children, and each of them had 5 or 6 kids, and each of them had, you know, 2 to 5 grand, you know, kids. And by the time you add it all up, it's a pretty tidy sum on that side of the family. And when they asked my great-grandmother about it, she said, well, Lord said be fruitful, multiply. I guess we've done our part. That was the way she thought of it, you know, is that she'd done her part in helping that. I'd say with the billions we've got on the earth that overall we've succeeded in filling the earth. And yet each time that we come up with doomsday scenario that we're all going to die, it's funny that something happens that we're able to support and things. Does that mean people were not going to have problems and that there's not going to be famines and lots of deaths and things? No. But the point is that God said this is a blessing, and it was a command to them. So they were supposed to have children. So I want to read you a couple of things from the Talmud that give you an idea about their ideas on children. The first one, children being a blessing from God, but part of that was that they felt like they were on loan from God, that God had loaned them the children, and they were their responsibility while they were here, but eventually these children would have to be out on their own and would be responsible to God, and that if they died, it was God taking them back. And so it was a really interesting view they had of the family there. Now, what I'm going to read you is a story. There were a lot of teaching that was done in the olden times through stories. And even in the Old Testament, when you start reading a lot of that, aren't a lot of them stories about what happened with the people there? Well, unlike the Old Testament, this is not an inspired book. Okay, this is a collection of ancient writings and things. But it gives you an idea of the stories they would tell that would get across the point that they were looking for. So this particular one is about a fellow who was called Rabbi Meir, and he had 2 sons. And it happened that while the rabbi was lecturing in the house of study on the afternoon of the Sabbath, his 2 sons died at home. And their mother laid them upon a bed and covered them with a sheet. And at the termination of the Sabbath, the rabbi returned to his house and asked where the children were. And his wife said to him, I want to ask you a question. Some time ago, a person came here and entrusted a valuable article to my care, and now he wants it back. Shall I restore it to him or not? And he answered, surely a pledge must be returned to its owner. And she said then, without asking for your consent, I gave it back to him. And she thereupon took him by the hand and led him into the upper room and removed the sheet from off the bodies. And when he saw them, he wept bitterly, and she said to her husband, did you not tell me that what has been entrusted to one's keeping must be restored on demand? And the Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Where did that quote come from? Job. And what was that? What was the instance of Job saying that? All of his children that he had lost, right? And so that gives you a little insight into what they felt like about that statement, is that even though this was a tragedy, they felt like since these children were on loan from God, the fact that they had died simply meant that God wanted them back then. See? So some of that comes into an interesting play as we start thinking about the attitudes that they had. Okay, now about the command to have children. And this was a good one. This is a story about Hezekiah. And we were talking about him Sunday morning. And if you remember, it's in Isaiah 38, chapter, verse 1. It's also over in 2 Kings. I think it's the 20th chapter. Hezekiah falls ill. And it says, for it is said, in those days Hezekiah was sick unto death. And Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, came to him and said to him, thus says the Lord, set your house in order, for you will die and not live. Now, before we go on to the next point there, that's the verse. And a lot of times the Jews would take a verse like this, and they have this way of looking at commentary on them called Midrash, where sometimes they'll add some stories in. Now, they don't necessarily mean that this is the exact thing that happens, but they're using these biblical characters to make a point, okay? And so they look at this verse and they go, well, now that's kind of interesting, because what's the meaning of you shall die and not live? Doesn't that seem like it's the same thing, just repeated twice? But they said, well, you shall die in this world and shall not live in the world to come. That's what they tacked onto it, right? Well, that's pretty harsh, folks. That's really harsh. And so he said to him, this would be Hezekiah saying to Isaiah, why? Why all of this? Why such a harsh punishment? Well, Isaiah says, because you did not engage in carrying out the religious duty to be fruitful and multiply. So that's how serious they took this. And so he said to him, it was because I saw by the Holy Spirit that from me would go forth sons who were not worthy. Now, anybody remember whose Hezekiah's son was? We're going to talk about him this next Sunday morning. Manasseh. What do we know about Manasseh? Yeah, good king, bad king. Yeah, like bottom of the heap bad king, right? Really bad guy. And so he's saying, well, you know, I saw that my son was going to be worthless, and so I just didn't want to have a son. Here's their thinking on that. He said to him, what business is it of yours to get involved with the secrets of the All-Merciful? What you are commanded to do is what you have to do. And what pleases the Holy One, blessed be he will do. Any truth in that philosophy? I think so. You know, a lot of times we want to excuse an action of ours to say, well, you know, I might not turn out well. And the point that they were making here was, you do what God asks you to do and let him figure out how it's supposed to turn out. And that's what they were putting on Hezekiah. Now, you might ask yourself, and they go, where did they get this? Well, think about it. Hezekiah was granted 15 more years when he repented, turned to the wall, and wept. And Isaiah came back and said, you've been granted 15 more years. And his son Manasseh was only 12 when he became king. So what does that mean? He hadn't the child. Manasseh was his oldest. He was childless at the time that he fell sick. And especially for someone who was sitting on the throne of David, that was considered a gross negligence of their duty. So that's the way they were thought about children, is they were a gift from God, they were part of the commandment, but then you add to that the just general nature of the longing for them, and I think you get an idea of why that shows up so important in the Old Testament scriptures. Let's sing a couple more songs here. Turn to number 318. I'm going to lead that one, and then I think Josh was going to... Josh, which one were you going to do? Number 10. Okay. Actually, let's turn number 205. I want to sing 205 first, then we'll sing number 10, and then we'll mark our books at 32. So number 205, actually. We've sung this before.
Swaddling robes.
So let's talk about the really early stages, childbirth, circumcision, naming, those kind of, you know, all come in a really short time period there. And if we go back and let's look at Jesus first, in Luke the second chapter in verse 12, and I've used the ESV translation here. It says, when the angels were talking to the shepherds in the field and telling them about this great event that was going to happen, they said, and this will be a sign for you. You will find a baby wrapped in swaddling clothes and lying in a manger. Now, the normal ritual that they would have gone through at childbirth would have been to first wash the child down with a salt water solution, and then they would rub them down with oil, and then they would wrap them up using a linen blanket or linen sheet, and that was called swaddling. Now, NASB just says in clothes, and several others leave out the swaddling term there, but that's really what they would have done. And that's kind of the image you get there, is this wrapped up, you know, I don't know, have you been to the hospitals where they put the newborns in the crib and they're all just kind of wrapped up there? Some kids like it and some kids don't. Now, they thought that what this did is, at least for the first few days, if you kept them, you know, from moving around, that it strengthened their limbs or helped straighten them out, I don't know. Anyway, they had some ideas about what it would do for the child. My eldest child, when he was born, you know, they tried this wrap them up tightly thing. And Aaron was like this. Got to get one arm out. So he didn't like the swaddling stuff, you know. He had to get an arm out and be active. My daughter, on the other hand, Miriam, you'd wrap her up and she would just kind of, you know, chill out. She was fine. It was all great. But that was the idea. You showed love and care and concern for this newborn child by going through that ritual. Okay? So, what do you make of a passage like in Ezekiel, the 16th chapter? If you look over there, Ezekiel 16, in the first five verses, this is another one of those abrupt times when Ezekiel's getting kind of rough with the people there. And he has some choice words. So let's take a look at them real quickly. Ezekiel 16, beginning in verse 1. The word of the Lord came to me saying, Son of man, make known to Jerusalem her abomination, and say, Thus says the Lord God to Jerusalem, Your origin and your birth are from the land of the Canaanite. Your father was an Amorite, and your mother was a Hittite. As for your birth, on the day you were born, your navel cord was not cut, nor were you washed with water for cleansing. You were not rubbed with salt or even wrapped in clothes. No eye looked with pity on you to do any of these things for you, to have compassion on you. Rather, you were thrown out into the open field, for you were abhorred on the day you were born. So, why does he use that kind of imagery when he's talking to the remnant there, those who are in exile? What point is he trying to get across to them? Yeah, from the language, it's obvious nobody cared, but I put to you that this would have been almost shocking to them. No one would have even considered treating a newborn child this way. And for him to say that they who had thought of themselves as children of God, he's saying, you're acting like your parents didn't care, and they abandoned you, were born, and didn't do anything that showed any compassion or care for you. That's what they were acting like. Now, the next verses say, I saw you, and I took care of you. And I think what he's talking about there is, you know, when they were coming out of Egypt, they were kind of a ragtag band of people, right? Who did they really follow? It kind of came out when they came to Aaron while Moses was on the mountain. Remember what happened there? They got all this gold together, and it just turned into this calf that walked out of the fire. Why was that? Well, that's what they've been used to worshiping, right? Back in Egypt. And he's saying, yeah, I took care of you. I did better than that. He uses this imagery to show the compassion that you should have had naturally for a child. Now, little side note here. In Luke, the second chapter, verse 7, when it's talking about Mary and Joseph, and they'd gone to Bethlehem, and in the most of the translations it says she gave birth to her firstborn, and she wrapped him in clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no room for them in the inn. And we think of this as being, wow, they must have been like out in the barn somewhere, you know. There's another way to look at it, because that word "in" there is the same word that Luke uses in chapter 22, verse 1, when Jesus is sending his disciples to go look for a place for them to have the Passover. And he says that you will find this man, and he will even say that the master has need of your guest room. The guest room was on the upper levels. In many of the cases, and especially in the archaeological finds that they've been looking at and the way these houses were built, many of the animals were kept on the first floor, on the ground floor, in some of the villages and things. Why would that be? Okay, the animals need protection too, right? It's not that they're, you know, being cast out. This is an enclosed area for protection. Also, if it gets cold, kind of get some shared heat there, right? And so it helps keep everybody warm in the wintertime. So the likelihood is this is talking about the guest room was full already because of the census going on, and so they had to stay down where the animals were. But it would have been in the house. It's not in some, you know, barn out in the field somewhere. They were with families and others there. And that's where the shepherds would have gone to look for them. So the inn's probably not the right word. But Jesus would have been wrapped up and would have gone through this same thing. So it's kind of hard in some ways. You know, that's why I sang that song, Emmanuel, God with us. It's hard to imagine Jesus having, you know, created the universe and then come down and be totally helpless, isn't it? And then you get a verse like this where it says, even for him, he would have been washed, and he would have been rubbed down and then bundled up to show that his mother loved him, just like they loved all of the children that were there. So we get that picture from our Savior. It's really kind of neat. Then there's circumcision and naming. Genesis 17:12, circumcision was a sign of which covenant? Quiz. Abrahamic covenant. What other covenants do we have? Okay, covenant with Noah. What was the sign of the covenant with Noah? Rainbow, right? Okay, other covenant. Got four big ones here, so we got two down. Got third one. Come on, you know this. Got Abraham, Noah first, then Abraham. What comes next? Moses. We got the Mosaic covenant, right? What's the sign of the Mosaic covenant? Oh, that's close, but not quite. Ah, not quite. That's the law. That's part of that covenant. That was part of the law. Every covenant has a sign and a law and promises associated with it. And time's up. It was the Sabbath. The Sabbath was the sign of their covenant. So when they were circumcised, it was the sign that they were part of Abraham's children, part of the Abrahamic covenant, and the blessings in Genesis 12 that were given to him. When they observed the Sabbath, it was a sign that they were accepting the law of Moses and the Mosaic covenant. What's the fourth covenant? Christ's covenant. What's the sign of that covenant? Okay, that was a major part of it. That was the sacrifice that was involved with him. Remember what he said when he instituted the Lord's Supper? This is the blood of my covenant. As often as you partake of it, remember me. So the sign that he wants us to remember for his new covenant is the Lord's Supper that we take every week, the sign of the covenant, okay? So, baptism is important. All of those things you mentioned are all part of it, right? What's baptism a part of? That's your birth into the covenant relationship. But that sign, I think, is the one that Jesus delivered when he instituted the Lord's Supper. Anyway, so, circumcision and naming. Every male among you who is 8 days old shall be circumcised throughout your generations. So, they would circumcise them, but for sons, the naming was part of the circumcision ritual. If you had daughters, it was just naming. They would still do that on the eighth day. And the idea was the parents would think about what name they wanted to name the child, but they wouldn't tell anybody until the eighth day. Now, there's several things about that. Sometimes they thought that, okay, there were losing a child early was a real problem then. They had a much higher rate of infant mortality than we're used to now in our country and our world. And so they really didn't want to give them a name if they weren't going to live at least 8 days. But when the eighth day came, it was time to name them as well as go through the circumcision ritual. So names traditionally had some significance to the family. You would pick something that was like a good, strong family name. How many Davids do we have in here? They reused names as badly as we do, right? But it was all family names. So when you look over in Luke, the first chapter, and you look at verses 57 to 63, can I get somebody to read that for me? This is when John is being named, and again, it's on his eighth day, he's going to be circumcised. They're going to go through a ritual there to circumcise him, and they're going to name him. But there was something interesting. Rick, please read that for me. All right. We read past that, but part of this is Zacharias can't talk, right? Normally it would have been the father's responsibility to tell him the name. And so his wife is jumping in here. So that's a little bit of breach of normal protocol for what this normally would have been. And then she says his name is going to be John. What's their reaction? You don't have any Johns in this family. Now, that was still a good Hebrew name, Yohanan. It's got a good derivation in terms of coming. Yahweh, Hanan, God is with us or something like that. It's a play on a very similar name to Jesus in some ways. But it wasn't a family name. And so when his father wrote down his name is John, they were astonished. It wasn't that he could write. They were astonished that he was picking this non-family name. Why did he pick the non-family name? He was told what the name was, right? When the angel visited him, that's how he lost his voice in the first place, was doubting this angel that came to him. But then after that, it says that he was able to speak and he was able to tell the story. So there's an interesting tradition that developed after the time of Christ. This was probably, best we can date, somewhere in the between 500 and 900 AD that this kind of tradition developed, but it's still in quite common practice today among Orthodox Jews, different traditions of it and others. Whenever the circumcision ritual is going to occur, they will bring out an ornate chair. Sometimes it's a plain chair with an ornate blanket on it. This one is one that was carved back in about 17-something as an antique, but it's an ornate chair, and it's called the chair of Elijah or the chair for Elijah. And that is set there as part of this ritual. Sometimes the godfather, who is supposed to hold the child while the circumcision takes place, will sit in it. Sometimes it's left empty. Sometimes there's a two-seater, and then he sits on one side, and then the other seat is left blank. Why would they pick Elijah? Two reasons. Why would they pick Elijah as wanting to be present here, at least symbolically, for this male child? How about 1 Kings 17 to 24? Anybody remember that one? We won't read all of that one. But Elijah is kind of on the run. He's gone to the widow of Zarephath. And the widow of Zarephath was running out of oil and was having problems, and Elijah basically saved them, right? What happens not too long after that? The son dies. Right? And what does Elijah do? He brings him back. And so Elijah was considered to be the protector of children because he had brought this child back for this woman. And so who better to sit there than that? But there's another reason too. In Malachi, the fourth chapter, verse 5, it says, "Behold, I'm going to send you Elijah, the prophet, before the coming of the great and terrible day of the Lord." They all recognize this is a messianic prophecy, that Elijah was going to come before the Messiah would come. Now, Jesus answered out how this had happened, who did he say that Elijah was? John the Baptist, right? He said, if you've seen John the Baptist, I tell you, Elijah has come. But they were still looking for this. They're still looking for the Messiah. So who better to sit and see if this child might be the Messiah than to have Elijah there? And so the idea is, if this child was going to be the Messiah, that maybe suddenly Elijah would really appear. And that would be a sign that this child was the long-sought Messiah. So there are a couple of reasons they do, and these rituals that come up around it shows the importance of it. Another interesting thing about the Jewish midrash, the Jewish reasoning from the scriptures, is some of it was pretty rational, some of it was pretty strange. This is an instance of where it's really rational. When you start looking at, they say they should be circumcised on the eighth day, but what happens if the eighth day is a Sabbath day when you're not supposed to do work, and there's all these other circumstances that come up? So they work through them. An infant is circumcised on the 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, or 12th day. Okay, where does that come from? Well, under normal circumstances, it's on the 8th day. If he's born at twilight, his circumcision is on the 9th day. In other words, if you're right at that boundary that you're not sure what day you were born on, because remember, the setting sun began the next day, right? So if it's right there, just to be safe, they go one more day over. If he was born at twilight on the eve of the Sabbath, he's circumcised on the 10th day, because he's got to pass, that would have put his circumcision on the Sabbath, which you got to jump over. And in the case of a festival which falls after the Sabbath, he'll be circumcised on the 11th day, on the Monday. And in the case of two festival days of the new year, he's circumcised on the 12th day. So they had all of these things worked out for when they weren't supposed to do things and what added up. But so you wound up with this, you know, explanation there. But I love this last one. A lot of times there were other things that they put in and that they tired, because when you start looking at what were the commandments of God to them, eighth day was what he wanted. These others fell in line with some of the other commands as they're sorting them out. But he said, an infant who is sick, they do not circumcise him until he gets well. Why would that be? Yeah, you don't further stress the child. They didn't want to, you know, potentially harm the child. So life was more important than this ritual. Does that make sense? So this kind of gives you an idea of the way they would rank these commands. Sometimes when there would be conflicts, they were able to sort through them and say which was more important. And in this case, life, the life of the child, was much more important. Okay, customs on the preference for sons. We'll just run through a couple of these real quickly. This comes from the Talmud. It's a discussion of a couple of rabbis. And the Lord blessed Abraham in all things. And the question came out to this group of rabbis and said, what is the meaning of in all things? And Rabbi Meir says, he had no daughter. Well, this other rabbi disagrees with him. Rabbi Judah says, he did so have a daughter, and her name was with all. Now, he gets that from another interesting passage of what he talks about there and whatnot. So Rabbi Meir comes back and he says, so on that basis, I may say indeed, you may conclude that the All-Merciful did not hold back from Abraham even a daughter, but that hardly proves that a daughter is preferable to a son. So they argued really strange things sometimes as they were trying to work through these passages. Another rabbi in a totally different discussion came up and he said this, a daughter is a worthless treasure for her father. For concern for her, he cannot sleep by night. In her childhood, it is lest she be seduced. In her girlhood, it is lest she play the whore. In her maturity, it is lest she not wed. Once she is wed, it is lest she not have sons. In her old age, it's lest she practice witchcraft. What is that basically saying? You always worry about your kids, right? It doesn't matter how old or young they are. You're always going to worry about your kids. But especially sometimes with a daughter. That was the idea. But they didn't all feel that way. Rabbi Samuel says, here where preference is given to the daughter, we deal with a woman who is giving birth for the first time. And the matter accords with Rabbi Hizda. For he said, when a daughter comes first, it's a good sign for the children. He wanted a daughter first. Said some say, that's because she helps raise her brothers. That true? Yeah, a lot of times it is, isn't it? You know, the older daughter gets stuck with a lot of that stuff. And some say it's because the evil eye provoked by envy has no power over her. So there's some superstitious things thrown in there. And this other rabbi says, for me, daughters are to be preferred over sons. So while there was kind of this tendency for got to need male heirs and things like that, there was not a total gender bias on that behalf like you find in some cultures. They treasure their daughters as well. And you see that a lot in the Old Testament. And then as you emerge from childhood, there is a point where the child starts turning into an adult. Now, that's not an overnight process, but they start it with at interesting age. They got it kind of mapped out. You've seen me show this one before, but I still love it. It's in the Perk Abot, one of the Mishnah sayings. At 5, to Scripture. When did they start teaching the Scripture to their children? Very early. From 10, to Mishnah. The Mishnah is a commentary on Scripture. In other words, they were now starting to discuss deeper things of the law with their children, even by the age of 10 years old. But look at that one. At 13, to religious duties. And that's the one where they're going to be transitioning from being a child to moving towards an adult. Now, the ritual that they go through there is called Bar Mitzvah, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But there's another reading here where it kind of gives you a sense of that as this transition. A girl 11 years old and one day old, her vows are examined. A girl 12 years old and one day old, her vows were confirmed. What's the difference between examined and confirmed in that state, do you think? A girl vows to do something. If she's 11, then the parents can examine that and go, no, you know, you shouldn't have been doing that. We can negate that. But if she's 12, then it's confirmed. Her vow holds. In other words, she's responsible now for her actions. But look at the male. They examine them throughout the 12th year. Now, there's the 12th year, they're kind of keeping a watch on them there. But a boy, 11, his vows are examined. A boy, 13, his vows are confirmed. What's that tell you? They recognize that, in general, girls mature before boys do, don't they? Okay, so that was pretty well known. And so even today, in the rituals, a young lady who's going to have what's called a bat mitzvah, it's at 12, and bar mitzvah is at 13, which is for the males. What does bar mitzvah mean? Anybody know what that means? Two words. Son, bar means son. Mitzvah is commandment. Okay? If you're ever reading any of the Jewish literature and things, that word comes up over and over. It's a mitzvah. In other words, it's a commandment. It's something that's required. And so we could literally be son of commandment, but the implication is you're now subject to the law. Okay? So that was kind of their age of accountability, was sort of coinciding with puberty, is the way they looked at it. Now, you weren't a man yet, okay? But at 13, you could be counted as one of the 10 males in a city that were required in order to form a synagogue, because you were now responsible for religious duties. And so at 13, you could do that. My children's names are Aaron, Miriam, and Benjamin. We lived in South Florida for many years, and with those three names down there, we needed to put up a Christmas tree, because otherwise everybody thought we were Jewish. And in fact, my eldest son was invited to read the Torah at one of his friend's bar mitzvahs. And then his mother had to call us up and very embarrassedly say, you know, I'm sorry. you're not Jewish. You can't do that. That's reserved for someone who's already been bar mitzvahed to be able to participate in that ceremony. So he was able to attend, but he wasn't able to actually participate. The Mishnah says, furthermore, a son cannot be declared rebellious once he has reached manhood at 13. So they actually puts that word in there. Remember in the old law, it said, what could they do with a rebellious child? They could be brought before the elders of the city as a rebellious child, and in extreme cases, even put to death. Well, at 13, they crossed a line where they could no longer be declared by their parents as a rebellious child. Now, that didn't mean they still weren't responsible. Now they're going to be tried on their own without their parents there, is what it amounted to. Still in childhood but transitioning, in Luke, the second chapter, we have the story of Jesus going to the temple. Remember what age he was? He was 12. That would have been the year before he would have been considered to be transitioning into that adult thing. So when he is found reading with them in the synagogue there and talking with them, it's not that he wouldn't have had religious training. Remember, they start training early. But he would not normally have been one who had been allowed to read. But he's doing fine, isn't he? even before he reaches the age of 13. Yeah, and again, that one's fairly late. I have to go look it up, but it's like between 500 and 700 AD, somewhere in that time frame. So it's quite a bit past when Jesus was there. But that's when they started having the bar mitzvah. But that saying of, you know, to 13, to the law and things like that, that dates even earlier than that. That dates back probably to the Babylonian captivity is when that sort of list was there. And I don't know if you noticed it, but I love the last one, if you go back to that one. You know, 40 to understanding, 50 to counsel, 60 to old age. Just cross that line. 70 to ripe old age. Not too bad yet. 80 to remarkable strength. That sounds pretty good. 90 to a bowed back. And at 100, he's like a corpse who's ready to depart and pass on from this world. So there's some truth in all of that, I think. Okay. That's really what I wanted to cover tonight. Hopefully that's been of interest to let you know how they loved their children, but children were a part of the culture. Children were part of what they considered to be their duty. But it was all mixed up together in this culture that treasured them and treated them as gifts from God. And I think that part of that culture is something that sometimes we're kind of missing in our modern age, as we get too busy sometimes with everything else in life to really pay attention to our kids. So there's parts of that. That while we're not under the same obligations exactly under the old law, but there's some good lessons there that I think it would behoove us to think about as we look at raising our children in this world today. We're going to sing number 32, and after we finish that song, I'm going to ask David, that David over there, to lead us in a closing prayer. So, number 32.